Welcome, cyber traveler, to Spider on the Web, the podcast for the outcast that's never outclassed and enjoys a good blast. I had originally intended to bring you, last week, half an hour of Cory Doctorow's striking new novel, Little Brother, but technical glitches along the way put the kibosh on this plan. Happily, the exciting first chapter has made it here this week despite all technology could do to help, and I'll bring it to you shortly. First, though, I have to finish playing the CD Bowen Eclectic, which I left incomplete in last week's podcast I called Music from Three Islands. And before I can get to that, I have to apologize copiously for forgetting to tell you all last week that Tony Smith's remarkable podcast, Starship Sofa, featured me reading a goofy short story of mine, Distraction, that week. Fortunately, it is still archived at the iTunes Store and at www.starshipsofa.com, and even more fortunately, I can make up for my dereliction of mutual inter-podcast plugging by passing on to you the following very exciting news from Starship Sofa, which just surfaced on Boing Boing. Check this out. Starship Sofa podcast becomes full-fledged audio science fiction magazine. The Starship Sofa podcast is metamorphosing into The Starship Sofa, the audio science fiction magazine, following in the great tradition of magazines like Analog, Asimov's, and Fantasy and Science Fiction. Tony says, each week the Starship Sofa will deliver a full package of SF-related audio material, all free, including audio fiction, fact audio essays, flash fiction, and poetry, all by leading names in the SF field. Many writers have agreed to let Starship Sofa narrate their works, including Ben Bova, Joe Haldeman, Alistair Reynolds, and M. John Harrison, to name just a few. There will be two shows a week. The Wednesday show, also known as Oral Delights, will contain narrated audio fiction, fact, and poetry, and the weekend show will be an in-depth look into an author's life and work. This week saw the first of the Metamorphosing with the Starship Sofa's Oral Delights show. Fiction was provided by Cage Baker's fantastic story, The Likely Lad. There were two poems by Bruce Boston and Laurel Winter, both winners of the Reisling Award for SF Poetry. Flash fiction came from a very short but very powerful story called Repeating the Past by Peter Watts, author of the amazing SF novel Blind Sight. In the weeks to come, Peter Watts will also be delivering a monthly narrated fact article. This part of the show will be called Reality Remastered. I like that. As for the weekend shows, Starship Sofa has her sights upon such writers as John Scalzi, Robert Charles Wilson, and Ken MacLeod. Amazing news. Thank you, Tony. And now, back to the CD, Bowen Eclectic, which is already in progress. Here's Kaz Brownlee with In the Morning Light.
Baby, that's right. I just wandered to your door. You know exactly what I came here for. You just look so beautiful tonight. I can't wait to see you this way in the morning light. If there's one thing that can make me smile, I'd sure like it to last a while. Baby, take this moment and turn it into a night. I can't wait to see you this way in the morning light. Every time I breathe, I get a sweet sensation. I just want to hold your attention all night. I can't wait to see you this way. Baby, I can't wait to see you this way. I can't wait to see you this way in the morning light.
Now that's the way to start a podcast. Okay, this next track is by Pauline LaBelle, who, by the way, has a wonderful CD out called Voices in the Sound, Love Songs to Bowen Island, from her musical of the same name. It's just amazing. It features performances by some of our best musicians, Corbin Keep, Toon Shoot, Moritz Bam, Michael Kraber, the list goes on and on. This track, however, is not an excerpt from Voices in the Sound. This is a standalone project, as far as I know, called Danse Marianne.
Danse dans mon cœur, une fille que je ne connais presque pas. Et comme elle danse tout seule, on dirait qu'elle est triste. Mais pour elle, chaque jour est sa piste. Marianne danse, danse Marianne. Je l'ai rencontrée dans la forêt, parmi les cèdres et les sapins. C'est là où elle construit la scène. Et d'habitude son partenaire est la brise pure et saine, avec qui elle partage sa joie et sa peine. Danse, Marianne, danse. Danse, Marianne, danse. Danse, Marianne, pour ta vie. Marianne qui m'appelle. Souviens-toi des beaux jours, la jeune fille dans le sable. C'est moi qui danse quand tu n'es pas capable. Danse, Marianne, danse. Danse, Marianne, danse. Danse, Marianne, pour ma vie. Danse, Marianne, danse. Danse, Marianne, danse. Danse, Marianne, pour
Le Belle, c'est belle. Next up is Julie Vick. For many years, Julie recorded with a group called Resin, or Rosin if you prefer, featuring some of the best musicians in the area. She has, as they say, gone solo. She's a remarkable singer-songwriter, and here is an example of her solo talent called Cotton Skies.
Slipping out of my skin for a while.
Gotta love that line about dropping out of gravity. All right, now here's something you probably weren't expecting from Bowen Island, British Columbia, Canada. Here's the Texicanos, and If You Were Not Born in Texas.
If you were not born in Texas, because of an evil twist of fate, just head on down to Beaumont. Don't even hesitate. When you reach Amarillo, Austin, or old San Antonio, as soon as you're in Texas, son, you'll we'll drink a Lone Star beer in El Paso. We'll feel that Texas freedom as we stand outside the Alamo. We'll dance a Texas two-step in Dallas, eat barbecue and chili in Waco. But when it's time to be leaving, face the fact that, man, you just can't go.
Call it extremely northwest Texas. Now here's the Naive with The Bee Is Silent.
Set his brains on fire for
doesn't sound that naive to me. All right, there's only one track left from the CD, Bowen Eclectic, and before I play it, I want to remind you the album was produced by the Bowen Island Arts Council to raise money for the Bowen Island Community Hall and Arts Center Fund. Incredibly, an album this packed with talent lacks an arts center. And if you want to help, if you like the music you just heard and would like to own the CD, well, my best advice is to email the man who handed me my copy, Matt Maxwell, at matt@aimlanguagelearning.com, all one word. Or you can try contacting the Arts Council through its website, http://biac.ca, no www. Hopefully they'll get around to posting ordering info for the CD soon, but Matt should know. Now, to close out the CD, Bowen Eclectic, here's a very strange track by a woman with a very beautiful name, Inez Ortner-Gigling and Blumen.
Manchmal bringt mir Blumen für die Nacht. Manchmal haben wir die Nächte zusammen durchwacht. Manchmal haben wir im Grase Liebe gemacht. Manchmal zähle ich die Stunden bis zur Nacht. Manchmal habe ich am Tage nur an ihn gedacht. Manchmal haben wir geweint und manchmal haben wir gelacht.
But that puts me perfectly in the mood to hear an excerpt from the new Cory Doctorow novel, Little Brother. Cory Doctorow is a Canadian blogger, journalist, and science fiction author who serves as co-editor of the amazing blog Boing Boing, of which I am a faithful subscriber. If you spend any time at all in cyberspace, you probably know him better than I do. He is famous as the first man ever to blog his winning of an award as he was on his way up to the dais to receive it. In any case, here's the opening of his new novel, Little Brother. He says, by the way, we're selling it as a download only, and Audible won't carry it because we won't put digital rights management on it, and they're only willing to sell books with DRM on. I'm also doing my own CC-like license that gives people who buy the book permission to use up to 30 minutes from it as part of any larger non-commercial project and freely redistribute it. This, he says, is my next novel, a young adult book about hacker kids who declare war on the Department of Homeland Security to bring the Bill of Rights back to America. Don't you love it? Bruce Schneier and Bunny Xbox hacker Huang both wrote afterwards for it, and Neil Gaiman said, quote, I'd recommend Little Brother over pretty much any book I've read this year, and I'd want to get it into the hands of as many smart 13-year-olds, male and female, as I can, unquote. Here's the opening chapter of Cory Doctorow's Little Brother, brought to you by Spider on the Web.
Listening Library presents Little Brother by Cory Doctorow. Read for you by Kirby Hayborn. Text copyright 2008 by Cory Doctorow. Production copyright 2008, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved. Chapter 1. I'm a senior at Cesar Chavez High in San Francisco's sunny Mission District, and that makes me one of the most surveilled people in the world. My name is Marcus Yallo, but back when this story starts, I was going by W1N5T0N, pronounced Winston. Not pronounced W1N5T0N, unless you're a clueless disciplinary officer who's far enough behind the curve that you still call the internet the information superhighway. I know just such a clueless person, and his name is Fred Benson, one of three vice principals at Cesar Chavez. He's a sucking chest wound of a human being, but if you're going to have a jailer, better a clueless one than one who's really on the ball.
Marcus Yallo, he said over the PA one Friday morning.
The PA isn't very good to begin with, and when you combine that with Benson's habitual mumble, you get something that sounds more like someone struggling to digest a bad burrito than a school announcement. But human beings are good at picking their names out of audio confusion. It's a survival trait. I grabbed my bag and folded my laptop three-quarters shut. I didn't want to blow my downloads. And got ready for the inevitable.
Report to the administration office immediately.
My social studies teacher, Mrs. Galvez, rolled her eyes at me, and I rolled my eyes back at her. The man was always coming down on me. Just because I go through school firewalls like wet Kleenex, spoof the gate recognition software, and nuke the snitch chips they track us with. Galvez is a good type, anyway. Never holds that against me. Especially when I'm helping get with her webmail so she can talk to her brother who's stationed in Iraq. My boy Daryl gave me a smack on the ass as I walked past. I've known Daryl since we were still in diapers and escaping from play school, and I've been getting him into and out of trouble the whole time. I raised my arms over my head like a prize fighter and made my exit from social studies and began the perp walk to the office. I was halfway there when my phone went. That was another no-no. Phones are muy prohibido at Chavez High. But why should that stop me? I ducked into the toilet and shut myself in the middle stall. The farthest stall is always grossest because so many people head straight for it, hoping to escape the smell and the squick. The smart money and good hygiene is down the middle. I checked the phone. My home PC had sent it an email to tell it that there was something new up on Harajuku Fun Madness, which happens to be the best game ever invented. I grinned. Spending Fridays at school was to suck anyway, and I was glad of the excuse to make my escape. I ambled the rest of the way to Benson's office and tossed him a wave as I sailed through the door.
If it isn't W1N5T0N, he said.
Frederick Benson. Social Security Number 545-03-2343. Date of birth, August 15th, 1962. Mother's maiden name, Debona. Hometown, Petaluma, is a lot taller than me. I'm a runty 5'8", while he stands 6'7", and his college basketball days are far enough behind him that his chest muscles have turned into saggy man boobs that were painfully obvious through his freebie.com polo shirts. He always looks like he's about to slam dunk your ass, and he's really into raising his voice for dramatic effect. Both these start to lose their efficacy with repeated application. Sorry. Nope, I said. I never heard of this R2-D2 character of yours.
W1N5T0N, he said, spelling it out again. He gave me a hairy eyeball and waited for me to wilt. Of course it was my handle, and had been for years. It was the identity I used when I was posting on message boards where I was making my contributions to the field of applied security research. You know, like sneaking out of school and disabling the Minder tracer on my phone. But he didn't know that this was my handle. Only a small number of people did, and I trusted them all to the end of the earth. Not ringing any bells, I said. I'd done some pretty cool stuff around school using that handle. I was very proud of my work on snitch tag killers, and if he could link the two identities, I'd be in trouble. No one at school ever called me W1N5T0N or even Winston, not even my pals. It was Marcus or nothing. Benson settled down behind his desk and tapped his class ring nervously on his blotter. He did this whenever things started to go bad for him. Poker players call stuff like this a tell, something that lets you know what's going on in the other guy's head. I knew Benson's tells backwards and forwards. Marcus, I hope you realize how serious this is. I will just as soon as you explain what this is, sir. I always say sir to authority figures when I'm messing with them. It's my own tell. He shook his head at me and looked down. Another tell. Any second now, he was going to start shouting at me. Listen, kiddo. It's time you came to grips with the fact that we know about what you've been doing and that we're not going to be lenient about it. You're going to be lucky if you're not expelled before this meeting is through. Do you want to graduate? Mr. Benson, you still haven't explained what the problem is. He slammed his hand down on the desk and then pointed his finger at me. The problem, Mr. Yallow, is that you've been engaged in criminal conspiracy to subvert this school's security system, and you have supplied security countermeasures to your fellow students. You know that we expelled Graciela Uriarte last week for using one of your devices. Uriarte had gotten a bad rap. She'd bought a radio jammer from a head shop near the 16th Street BART station, and it had set off the countermeasures in the school hallway. Not my doing, but I felt for. And you think I'm involved in that? We have reliable intelligence indicating that you are W1N5T0N. Again, he spelled it out. And I began to wonder if he hadn't figured out that the 1 was an I and the 5 was an S. We know that this W1N5T0N character is responsible for the theft of last year's standardized tests. That actually hadn't been me, but it was a sweet hack, and it was kind of flattering to hear it attributed to me. And therefore liable for several years in prison unless you cooperate with me. You have reliable intelligence? I'd like to see it. He glowered at me. Your attitude isn't going to help you. If there's evidence, sir, I think you should call the police and turn it over to them. It sounds like this is a very serious matter, and I wouldn't want to stand in the way of a proper investigation by the duly constituted authorities. You want me to call the police. And my parents, I think. That would be for the best. We stared at each other across the desk. He'd clearly expected me to fold the second he dropped the bomb on me. I don't fold. I have a trick for staring down people like Benson. I look slightly to the left of their heads and think about the lyrics to old Irish folk songs, the kind with 300 verses. It makes me look perfectly composed and unworried. And the wing was on the bird, and the bird was on the egg, and the egg was in the nest, and the nest was on the leaf, and the leaf was on the twig, and the twig was on the branch, and the branch was on the limb, and the limb was in the tree, and the tree was in the bog down in the valley, oh. Hi-ho, the rattlin' bog, the bog down in the valley, oh. You can return to class now, he said. I'll call on you once the police are ready to speak to you. Are you going to call them now? The procedure for calling in the police is complicated. I had hoped that we could settle this fairly and quickly, but since you insist... I can wait while you call them is all, I said. I don't mind. He tapped his ring again, and I braced for the blast.
Go! He yelled. Get the hell out of my office, you miserable little...
I got out, keeping my expression neutral. He wasn't going to call the cops. If he'd had enough evidence to go to the police with, he would have called them in the first place. He hated my guts. I figured he'd heard some unverified gossip and hoped to spook me into confirming it. I moved down the corridor, lightly and sprightly, keeping my gait even and measured for the gate recognition cameras. These had been installed only a year before, and I loved them for their sheer idiocy. Beforehand, we'd had face recognition cameras covering nearly every public space in school, but a court ruled that was unconstitutional. So Benson and a lot of other paranoid school administrators had spent our textbook dollars on these idiot cameras that were supposed to be able to tell one person's walk from another. Yeah, right. I got back to class and sat down again, Ms. Galvez warmly welcoming me back. I unpacked the school's standard-issue machine and got back into classroom mode. The school books were the snitchiest technology of them all. Logging every keystroke, watching all the network traffic for suspicious keywords, counting every click, keeping track of every fleeting thought you put out over the net. We'd gotten them in my junior year, and it only took a couple months for the shininess to wear off. Once people figured out that these free laptops worked for the man and showed a never-ending parade of obnoxious ads to boot, they suddenly started to feel very heavy and burdensome. Cracking my schoolbook had been easy. The crack was online within a month of the machine showing up, and there was nothing to it. Just download a DVD image, burn it, stick it in the schoolbook, and boot it while holding down a bunch of different keys at the same time. The DVD did the rest, installing a whole bunch of hidden programs on the machine, programs that would stay hidden even when the Board of Ed did its daily remote integrity checks of the machines. Every now and again, I had to get an update for the software to get around the board's latest tests, but it was a small price to pay to get a little control over the box. I fired up I Am Paranoid, the secret instant messenger that I used when I wanted to have an off-the-record discussion, right in the middle of class. Daryl was already logged in. The game's afoot. Something big is going down with Harajuku Fun Madness, dude. You in? No freaking way. If I get caught ditching a third time, I'm expelled. Man, you know that. We'll go after school. You've got lunch and then study hall, right? That's 2 hours. Plenty of time to run down this clue and get back before anyone misses us. I'll get the whole team out. Harajuku Fun Madness is the best game ever made. I know I already said that, but it bears repeating. It's an ARG, an alternate reality game, and the story goes that a gang of Japanese fashion teens discovered a miraculous healing gem at the temple in Harajuku, which is basically where cool Japanese teenagers invented every major subculture for the past 10 years. They're being hunted by evil monks, the Yakuza, a.k.a. the Japanese mafia, aliens, tax inspectors, parents, and a rogue artificial intelligence. They slip the players coded messages that we have to decode and use to track down clues that lead to more coded messages and more clues. Imagine the best afternoon you've ever spent prowling the streets of a city, checking out all the weird people, funny handbills, street maniacs, and funky shops. Now add a scavenger hunt to that. One that requires you to research crazy old films and songs and teen culture from around the world and across time and space. And it's a competition, with the winning team of four taking a grand prize of 10 days in Tokyo, chilling on Harajuku Bridge, geeking out in Akihabara, and taking home all the Astro Boy merchandise you can eat. Except that he's called Adam Boy in Japan. That's Harajuku Fun Madness. And once you've solved a puzzle or two, you'll never look back.
No, man, just no. No. Don't even ask. I need you, Dee. You're the best I've got. I swear I'll get us in and out without anyone knowing it. You know I can do that, right? I know you can do it. So you're in? Hell no. Come on, Daryl. You're not going to your deathbed wishing you'd spent more study periods sitting in school. I'm not going to my deathbed wishing I'd spent more time playing ARGs either. Yeah, but don't you think you might go to your deathbed wishing you'd spent more time with Vanessa Pock? Van was part of my team. She went to a private girls' school in the East Bay, but I knew she'd ditch to come out and run the mission with me. Daryl has had a crush on her, literally, for years, even before puberty endowed her with many lavish gifts. Daryl had fallen in love with her mind. Sad, really. You suck. You're coming? He looked at me and shook his head. Then he nodded. I winked at him and set to work getting in touch with the rest of my team. I wasn't always into arguing. I have a dark secret. I used to be a LARPer. LARPing is live-action role-playing, and it's just about what it sounds like. Running around in costume, talking in a funny accent, pretending to be a super spy or a vampire or a medieval knight. It's like Capture the Flag in Monster Drag, with a bit of drama club thrown in. And the best games were the ones we played in scout camps out of town in Sonoma or down on the peninsula. Those three-day epics could get pretty hairy, with all-day hikes, epic battles with foam and bamboo swords, casting spells by throwing beanbags and shouting, "Fireball!" and so on. Good fun, if a little goofy. Not nearly as geeky as talking about what your elf planned on doing as you sat around a table loaded with Diet Coke cans and painted miniatures, and more physically active than going into a mouse coma in front of a massively multiplayer game at home. The thing that got me into trouble were the mini-games in the hotels. Whenever a science fiction convention came to town, some LARPer would convince them to let us run a couple of six-hour mini-games at the con, piggybacking on their rental of the space. Having a bunch of enthusiastic kids running around in costume lent color to the event, and we got to have a ball among people even more socially deviant than us. The problem with hotels is that they have a lot of non-gamers in them, too. They're not just sci-fi people. Normal people. From states that begin and end with vowels. On holidays. And sometimes those people misunderstand the nature of a game. Let's just leave it at that, okay? Class ended in 10 minutes, and that didn't leave me with much time to prepare. The first order of business was those pesky gate recognition cameras. Like I said, they'd started out as face recognition cameras, but those had been ruled unconstitutional. As far as I know, no court has yet determined whether these gate cams are any more legal, but until they do, we're stuck with them. Gate is a fancy word for the way you walk. People are pretty good at spotting gates. Next time you're on a camping trip, check out the bobbing of the flashlight as a distant friend approaches you. Chances are you can identify him just from the movement of the light, the characteristic way it bobs up and down that tells our monkey brains that this is a person approaching us. Gate recognition software takes pictures of your motion, tries to isolate you in the pics as a silhouette, and then tries to match the silhouette to a database to see if it knows who you are. It's a biometric identifier like fingerprints or retina scans, but it's got a lot more collisions than either of those. A biometric collision is when a measurement matches more than one person. Only you have your fingerprint, but you share your gait with plenty other people. Not exactly, of course. Your personal inch-by-inch walk is yours and yours alone. The problem is your inch-by-inch walk changes based on how tired you are, what the floor is made of, whether you pulled your ankle playing basketball, and whether you've changed your shoes lately. So the system kind of fuzzes out your profile, looking for people who walk kind of like you. There are a lot of people who walk kind of like you. What's more, it's easy not to walk kind of like you. Just take one shoe off. Of course, you'll always walk like you with one shoe off in that case, so the cameras will eventually figure out that it's still you. Which is why I prefer to inject a little randomness into my attacks on gait recognition. I put a handful of gravel into each shoe. Cheap and effective. And no two steps are the same. Plus, you get a great reflexology foot massage in the process. I kid. Reflexology is about as scientifically useful as gait recognition. The cameras used to set off an alert every time someone they didn't recognize stepped onto campus. This did not work. The alarm went off every 10 minutes, when the mailman came by, when a parent dropped in, when the groundspeople went to work fixing up the basketball court, when a student showed up wearing new shoes. So now it just tries to keep track of who's where, when. If someone leaves by the school gates during classes, their gait is checked to see if it kinda sorta matches any student gait, and if it does, whoop, 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 ring the alarm. Chavez High is ringed with gravel walkways. I like to keep a couple hands full of rocks in my shoulder bag, just in case. I silently pass Daryl 10 or 15 pointy little bastards, and we both loaded our shoes. Class was about to finish up, and I realized that I still hadn't checked the Harajuku Fun Madness site to see where the next clue was. I'd been a little hyper-focused on the escape and hadn't bothered to figure out where we were escaping to. I turned to my school book and hit the keyboard. The web browser we used was supplied with the machine. It was a locked-down spyware version of Internet Explorer, Microsoft's crashware turd that no one under the age of 40 used voluntarily. I had a copy of Firefox on the USB drive built into my watch, but that wasn't enough. The schoolbook ran Windows Vista for Schools, an antique operating system designed to give school administrators the illusion that they controlled the programs their students could run. But Vista for Schools is its own worst enemy. There are a lot of programs that Vista for Schools doesn't want you to be able to shut down. Keyloggers, sensorware, and these programs run in a special mode that makes them invisible to the system. You can't quit them because you can't even see they're there. Any program whose name starts with $SYS$ is invisible to the operating system. It doesn't show up on listings of the hard drive, nor in the process monitor. So my copy of Firefox was called $SYS$Firefox. And as I launched it, it became invisible to Windows, and thus invisible to the network's snoopware. Now that I had an indie browser running, I needed an indie network connection. The school's network logged every click in and out of the system, which was bad news if you were planning on surfing over to the Harajuku Fun Madness site for some extracurricular fun. The answer is something ingenious called Tor, the Onion Router. An Onion Router is an internet site that takes requests for web pages and passes them on to other Onion Routers, and on to other Onion Routers, until one of them finally decides to fetch the page and pass it back through the layers of the Onion until it reaches you. The traffic to the Onion Routers is encrypted, which means that the school can't see what you're asking for, and the layers of the Onion don't know who they're working for. There are millions of nodes. The program was set up by the U.S. Office of Naval Research to help their people get around the censorware in countries like Syria and China, which means that it's perfectly designed for operating in the confines of an average American high school. Tor works because the school has a finite blacklist of naughty addresses we aren't allowed to visit, and the addresses of the nodes change all the time. No way could the school keep track of them all. Firefox and Tor together made me into the invisible man, impervious to Board of Ed snooping, free to check out the Harajuku FM site and see what was up. There it was, a new clue. Like all Harajuku Fun Madness clues, it had a physical, online, and mental component. The online component was a puzzle you had to solve. one that required you to research the answers to a bunch of obscure questions. This batch included a bunch of questions on the plots in doujinshi. Those are comic books drawn by fans of manga, Japanese comics. They can be as big as the official comics that inspire them, but they're a lot weirder, with crossover storylines and sometimes really silly songs and action. Lots of love stories, of course. Everyone loves to see their favorite tunes hook up. I'd have to solve those riddles later, when I got home. They were easiest to solve with the whole team, downloading tons of doujinshi files and scouring them for answers to the puzzles. I'd just finished scrapbooking all the clues when the bell rang and we began our escape. I surreptitiously slid the gravel down the side of my short boots, ankle-high Blundstones from Australia, great for running and climbing, and the easy slip-on, slip-off laceless design makes them convenient at the never-ending metal detectors that are everywhere now. We also had to evade physical surveillance, of course, but that gets easier every time they add a new layer of physical snoopery. All the bells and whistles lull our beloved faculty into a totally false sense of security. We surfed the crowd down the hallways, heading for my favorite side exit. We were halfway along when Daryl hissed, "Crap! I forgot! I've got a library book in my bag!" "You're kidding me," I said, and hauled him into the next bathroom we passed. Library books are bad news. Every one of them has an ARFID, radio frequency ID tag, glued into its binding, which makes it possible for the librarians to check out the books by waving them over a reader, and lets a library shelf tell you if any of the books on it are out of place. But it also lets the school track where you are at all times. It was another of those legal loopholes. The courts wouldn't let the schools track us with ARFIDs, but they could track library books and use the school records to tell them who was likely to be carrying which library book. I had a little Faraday pouch in my bag. These are little wallets lined with a mesh of copper wires that effectively block radio energy, silencing ARFIDs. But the pouches were made for neutralizing ID cards and toll book transponders, not books like Introduction to Physics, I groaned. The book was the size of a dictionary. Chapter 2. I'm thinking of majoring in physics when I go to Berkeley, Daryl said. His dad taught at the University of California at Berkeley, which meant he'd get free tuition when he went. And there'd never been any question in Daryl's household about whether he'd go. Fine, but couldn't you research it online? My dad said I should read it. Besides, I didn't plan on committing any crimes today. Skipping school isn't a crime. It's an infraction. They're totally different. What are we going to do, Marcus? Well, I can't hide it, so I'm going to have to nuke it. Killing ARFIDs is a dark art. No merchant wants malicious customers going for a walk around the shop floor and leaving behind a bunch of lobotomized merchandise that is missing its invisible barcode, so the manufacturers have refused to implement a kill signal that you can radio to an ARFID to get it to switch off. You can reprogram ARFIDs with the right box, but I hate doing that to library books. It's not exactly tearing pages out of a book, but it's still bad, since a book with a reprogrammed ARFID can't be shelved and can't be found. It just becomes a needle in a haystack. That left me with only one option, nuking the thing. Literally, 30 seconds in a microwave will do in pretty much every ARFID on the market. And because the ARFID wouldn't answer at all when Dee checked it back in at the library, they'd just print a fresh one for it and recode it with the book's catalog info, and it would end up clean and neat back on its shelf. All we needed was a microwave. Give it another 2 minutes and the teacher's lounge will be empty, I said. Daryl grabbed his book and headed for the door. Forget it. No way. I'm going to class. I snagged his elbow and dragged him back. Come on, Dee. Easy now. It'll be fine. The teacher's lounge? Maybe you weren't listening, Marcus. If I get busted just once more, I am expelled. You hear that? Expelled. You won't get caught, I said. The one place a teacher wouldn't be after this period was the lounge. We'll go in the back way. The lounge had a little kitchenette off to one side, with its own entrance for teachers who just wanted to pop in and get a cup of joe. The microwave, which always reeked of popcorn and spilled soup, was right in there, on top of the miniature fridge. Daryl groaned. I thought fast. Look, the bell's already rung. If you go to study hall now, you'll get a late slip. Better not to show it all at this point. I can infiltrate and exfiltrate any room on this campus, Dee. You've seen me do it. I'll keep you safe, bro. He groaned again. That was one of Daryl's tells. Once he starts groaning, he's ready to give in. Let's roll, I said, and we took off.
All right, that was chapter one of Little Brother by the writer I think of as the farsighted Mr. McBoing Boing, Cory Doctorow. Like all its predecessors meant to say, this podcast was brought to you under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. Now to play you out, here's a track from Mile 41, an amazing recent CD by an incredible Vancouver pianist and vocalist named Jennifer Scott, backed by Renee Wurst on bass, Bernie Urai on drums, and Tom Keenlyside on tenor, soprano, flute, clarinet, etc. Here's the closing track from Mile 41, an amazing version of James Taylor's If I Keep My Heart Out of Sight. Jennifer Scott.
If I keep on talking now, I'll only start repeating myself, and all I can say is I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. If I slip and tip my hand, I'm certain to scare you away. Then what would I say? I'd be hurting, I'm certain. I'd be uncool to let you know that you're the one, the fool who jumped the gun. And I've been advised by other girls you've left behind. Your goodbyes are somewhat unrefined. But if I play my role just right, tonight could be my lucky night. And you could be mine. With a flower in the moonlight, oh, shiny and new. Well, you couldn't say no tonight. If I keep my heart out of sight, if I play my role just right, then tonight could be my lucky night. And you could be mine if I present it to you with a flower in the moonlight, shiny and new. Well, you couldn't say no tonight. If I keep my heart out of sight.
Thanks for your donations and subscriptions. We'll see you next week with more Spider on the Web.